sacrifice. Your nostril is another plate of sacrifice. In your belly is the eating plate of sacrifice, and another plate of sacrifice is the holes of your ears. In your mouth is the Brahma plate of sacrifice. Your throat is the plate of sacrifice known as Soma, and whatever you chew is known as Agnihotra. Responsibly, O Lord, your tongue is a plate of sacrifice. Your nostril is another plate of sacrifice. Your belly is the eating place of sacrifice. And another plate of sacrifice is the holes of your ears. In your mouth is the Brahma plate of sacrifice. Your throat is the plate of sacrifice known as Soma. And whatever you chew is known as Agnihotra. Report by Srila Prabhupada. The Veda Vadis say that there is nothing more than the Vedas and the performances of sacrifice mentioned in the Vedas. They have recently made a rule in their group to formally observe daily sacrifice. They simply ignite a small fire and offer something whimsically, but they do not strictly follow the sacrificial rules and regulations mentioned in the Vedas. It is understood that by regulation there are different plates of sacrifice required, such as Srak, Suva, Varhis, Chaturhotra, Ida, Chamasa, Prashitra, Graha, and Agnihotra. One cannot achieve the results of sacrifice unless one observes the strict regulations. In this age, there is practically no facility for performing sacrifices in strict discipline. Therefore, in this age of Kali, there is a stricture regarding such sacrifices. It is explicitly directed that one should perform Sankirtan Yajna and nothing more. The incarnation of the Supreme Lord is Yageshwar, and unless one has respect for the incarnation of the Lord, he cannot perfectly perform sacrifice. In other words, taking shelter of the Lord and rendering service unto him is the factual performance of all sacrifices, as explained herein. Different plates of sacrifice correspond to the different parts of the body of the Lord's incarnation. In the Srimad Bhagavatam 11th canto, it is explicitly directed that one should perform Sankirtan Yajna to please the Lord's incarnation as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This should be rigidly followed in order to achieve the result of Yajna performance. Om Agnati Mandasagana Anjana Salakaya Chaksurun Militam Jena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha Sri Chaitanya Manuvistam Stapitam Jena Bhutale Svayam Rupakaramaya Dharati Svaparantikam Mukham Karoti Vachalam Bangam Bangayate Girim Yat Kripatara Hambande Sri Guru Dinatarane. Prabhupada's emphasizing the importance of Sankirtan Yajna over other types of yajna, fire sacrifices, Agnihotra, Chaturhotra, and so on. There are a lot of people, as he mentions here, Vedavadis, for example, who say that there's nothing more than the Vedas, and they perform sacrifices, and they Veda rule, he says, to observe this daily. Sometimes people act in the realm of superstition. They abide by things like astrology is absolute, not being aware that Prabhupada, although he appreciated and respected this great science, sometimes did things that were very unastrological. There are people, I've met some who think it's important to have what they call real yajnas, that is, fires, and fire sacrifices, and to throw things in, and that the Vedas are the ultimate reality, and that they give all the prescriptions for what to do. And this is a way of describing the Hare Krishna movement as not being authentic because it doesn't abide by the Vedas as the original sources of knowledge. And there's a certain strain in academia that says that if one doesn't go back to original sources like the Vedas, or the original spoken words of, verbatim words of Prabhupada, then it is not possible to come to right conclusions. That's a strain of thought. It's a theory. And while there's some truth to it, it's sometimes being established in some people's minds as being the only truth or the absolute truth. And in this way, there's a kind of relativization of Prabhupada's teachings. There's a conference called Vaishnava Advanced Studies, and some members of that conference are openly critical, almost, I guess you could say, taking swipes, as we say in America, at Srila Prabhupada by saying that he didn't hearken back to the original sources. He relied upon people like Sridhar Swami and Vishwanath Chakravarti and Rupa Goswami and Sanatana Goswami and Madhvacharya and Ramanuja and others, and therefore not going back to the original sources, the Vedas, that his teaching has become distorted and unreliable, and he's relativized in the sense that he's just one of the number of many devotee disciples of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur. So that battle is going on kind of among the so-called intellectual class of devotees. I wouldn't say it's exactly a battle, but there's a type of kind of, you might say, guerrilla warfare going on of certain of Prabhupada's disciples who are critical of this. And here Prabhupada is indirectly condemning this mentality by saying that there's a group called the Vedavadis that say you have to hearken back to the original Vedas. And he mentions the different types of sacrifice. And of course the conclusion that Prabhupada gives here is that all other types of sacrifice are, in this age, not appropriate, not considered useful. And he mentions the verse in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, Krishna Varnam Tvisha Krishnam Sangopangasta Parshadam, in which it is said that people who have sufficient brain substance will worship the Supreme Personality of God, who is always chanting the holy names of the Lord. And of course, there are other places in the Bhagavatam which establish that in this age, one can get the same benefits by chanting as one could have gotten in previous ages by sacrifice, by temple worship, and by meditation. Kriti adyayato vishnum, tretayam yajato makai, dvapare paricharyayam kalo tad dari kirtanad. In the age of Kali, Kali tad daru kirtanad, one should chant the holy name of the Lord. And in this way, the Supreme Lord of all sacrifice, Yajeshwara, will be satisfied. He won't be satisfied by relying upon temple worship, by relying upon meditation and sacrifice. These things will not be effective in this age, according to Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not something that Prabhupada made up. In fact, we'll find in the Bhagavatam that chanting is valuable in all the ages. Even though it may not be the prescribed method, still it awakens a certain consciousness, just like we were hearing in this description of the gathering in indoor. These people were mostly impersonalists, but when they heard the holy name, it awakened their natural sense of Krishna consciousness. They began to clap, they began to dance, they began to chant. So this is the what Lord Chaitanya says, Nityasiddha Krishna Prema Saja Kavanai, that is not something that is attained or acquired from an external source. It's in the heart of everyone, and the chanting of the Krishna mantra is a matter of awakening something that's already there. And that is proof positive of what the Bhagavatam says about in the age of Kali, this is the best method. People won't be attracted to sacrifices or temple worship. They won't be attracted to meditation. Of course, people try to meditate, and their ideas of meditation are very strange, very quirky, we might say. But as soon as anybody, even people who've never heard it before, at least in this lifetime, there are instances of devotees chanting in to tribal peoples in Africa and then in Alaska who'd never ever heard the Hare Krishna mantra, and they were very attracted. They started dancing and chanting and smiling and taking part. And even sometime I saw one photograph of some Maasai warriors in Kenya, and they were chanting and dancing, and they loved prasadam, and they were very interested to find out what the philosophy was. So they were holding a back to God, is of course they couldn't read English, and the interesting thing about the picture is they were staring at these pages, but they were holding them upside down. But they were very attracted. They wanted to know, you know, what it was, and it was very interesting. Uh, Yeah, so Prabhupada says the incarnation of the Supreme Lord is Yageshwar. Another thing about the age of Kali is that there's some misunderstanding maybe about the Mahabharata, and just in general about decimating people who don't believe in Hare Krishna or don't chant, or the demons get sort of killed in the Mahabharata. And I've heard the story about someone asking Prabhupada about, well, what if later on, you know, Hare Krishna is very popular, but some people don't want to chant, and the story goes that Prabhupada said, we'll take a gun and shoot them. So based upon this and other references that are to be found here and there, sometimes that attitude is there. It's interesting, however, that in the Lila of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, which we basically live by, the Astra was the Shastra in a simple way of speaking, and people like the Kazi, who was of another mentality, a meat eater and doing all sorts of cruel things, was very attractive. And his samadhi or grave is still worshipped today. I mean, people go there on the Parikram in Vrindavan, we've seen it. So he was convinced by Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. They had a discussion after he tried to stop the Sankirtan, after he broke the Mridangas. They had a philosophical discussion on the Shastra. And he was convinced that there was something extraordinary going on, and he allowed the Sankirtan movement to go on in his province. There's another story, I think it's in Chaitanya Bhagavat, that when Sanatan Goswami was advising the Muslim ruler, and he was asked about, who is this Lord Chaitanya? He's, as a king, as a Patan king, he noticed that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always had a lot of followers. And as a king, he thought that this is extraordinary. Just like Pilate and other people during the time of Jesus Christ, they thought this is extraordinary. All these people were following him. And Sanatan advised him that this is not an ordinary person, maybe a different religion, but actually he's a great saint, and he's in your province, in your kingdom, so you should give him all facility. And he also became convinced that way, that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was not an ordinary Hindu. He was a special person. And even Sanatan said, he used a word, I don't know what it was, because it was somehow rather deleted from the thing I looked it up in. But he used a word, it's like peer, it's a Muslim word that means a holy saint, a special, like a mullah, a special priest. And he said that actually that's what he is. He's in your kingdom and he's a great priest, so you should give him all facility to carry on. So-called purists like to rely on the Vedas. They're called, as Prabhupada mentions, Vedavadi or Vedavadi, Vedavadaratas. And the Bhagavad Gita actually specifically instructs that one should Vishaya Veda, Nishtrigunya Bhavarjana. One should arise above the modes of nature, and that the Vedas, they deal mainly with the three modes of material nature, Vishaya. That's what they deal with. So it's explained there, and one who relies upon them is not going to get the ultimate benefit of Krishna consciousness because of that. And all throughout the Bhagavad Gita, actually Bhagavad Gita is a kind of a treatise on bhakti, ultimately. One who studies it. Of course, it would not be possible to know that because modern thinkers and philosophers and speakers will say that the Bhagavad Gita, like these people that were in the convention that Prabhupada attended, has karma yoga, it has jnana yoga, it has raja yoga, it has just plain yoga, and that we, like Arjuna, have the option to choose which one we want. But people like Prabhupada have illustrated and shown us through the writings of other, and through the Siddhanta of other great teachers, that the Bhagavad Gita actually establishes Bhaktya Mama Vijanati Yavanyas Chashmi Tatvataha in the 18th chapter and in many other places, that if we actually want to know Krishna, Vedashtra Sarva Aham Eva Vedyo Vedanta Krita Eva Vedeva Chaham. Krishna says that I am the Veda, and you can only know me as I am through bhakti. That's the conclusion of Bhagavad Gita. So just like good lawyers can make the law illegal, interpreters can make the Bhagavad Gita adhere to any philosophy they want, including jnana yoga, hatha yoga, raja yoga, karma yoga, kriya yoga, you name it, they'll use Bhagavad Gita to back up their philosophy. And that's a very commonly done thing today. It's what we might call intellectual dishonesty or mental laziness, that a quote is selected from the Bhagavad Gita, and whatever our particular mentality is, instead of researching it carefully or studying very deeply the Siddhantas and the conclusions of various great souls, like Vyasadeva and Srila Prabhupada, a quote will be used to back up a particular point of view, whatever it may be. So that's a kind of a warning that people have to be on guard on. I was explaining on Saturday that when universities first began, the only subject matters for study were theology or the church, law, and medicine. Then around about the 19th century, universities developed a kind of ivory tower mentality. That is, they were purist and detached from the modern ways of things. And then in the 20th century, universities began to embrace technology and began to develop what people might sometimes loosely refer to as character, as opposed to, say, the genius of being isolated and living in an ivory tower. So education became much more, quote, practical, end quote, and emphasis on classical teachings, on mathematics, on learning diminished. And now people are sometimes lamenting that education, at least in America, which is supposed to be the cutting edge of education, which it really isn't, is emphasizing mental health above everything else, and that learning skills are secondary. People that are in charge of tertiary education are often saying that this 19th century way of looking at education was very isolated, ivory towerish, pure and isolated. And it's part of being the sort of dominant political force in the world, the United States of America. Dominant force, meaning politically, maybe intellectually, maybe other ways, but those are dominant, intellectually, scientifically. And one of the justifications is that if people study with an idea to maintaining political power, they will study technology and therefore maintain an edge over the rest of the world. They'll have better computers, better weaponry, and better economics. This is another form of power over the rest of the world. That it's in a way, it's kind of natural. You sort of have to forgive people like, say, the British Empire, the Roman Empire, Hitler's Empire, the American Empire, in a way, because most people are just kind of working. They just don't know any better. They're trying to maintain their families. They're getting paid. They're just trying to get by. They're not consciously trying to have power over the rest of the world, although they're very proud. Oh, yes, I'm an American. I'm a Britisher. I'm a Roman, whatever they are or were. They're very proud. But what's happened is that the institutes of so-called higher learning have become very technical and practical. So the idea of learning in a traditional sense has become one of being able to get a good paying job, being able to maintain political, economic, and intellectual power over the rest of the world, so-called cutting-edge education in America is that way. And this is the rhetoric you'll hear from many, many, probably most university presidents. So I'm not just sort of speculating about this. I've read some of their speeches, and this is kind of the mentality. It was said in the 19th century, there was a German poet named Goethe who said that geniuses work in isolation, and that real character comes when we're out in the world doing things and taking part. And that's the way most university presidents feel their university should be oriented towards making their country strong. That's their kind of behind-the-scenes motivation of what's going on. Again, as Prabhupada often said, the thing that's missing in education is knowing who we are, where we're going, that there's a soul. And until that's reinstated, people are going to lust after political, intellectual, scientific, philosophical power. It's inevitable. It's almost forgivable, because we could say that they don't know what they're doing. So in that sense, to try to bring Krishna consciousness into the world means to educate people, to bring them to the right understanding. A very, very important mission. Oh, one thing that Prabhupada said, he was asked in a conversation once about purification, because people were asking about, well, what is this purification? And how do you get purified? And this is something we don't encounter too often, purifying, getting purified, and purity and purification, what does it mean? And in several times during that conversation, in almost in the same sentence, he said, chanting, dancing, and eating prasadam is the way to get purified in this age, over and over again. Chanting, dancing, and eating prasadam. So sometimes if we're not in the realm of what we call making a difference, doing something really big, if we chant, dance, take prasadam, and relish this and learn to love Krishna, then we will be successful. And by coming in contact with successful people, happy people, people that are getting purified, there will be the grassroots or the individual perfection will spread and become something more like a movement. So I'll stop there if you have any comments. Questions. Palace?
Shoot people with a gun or shoot people with a holy name?
But no, Prabhupada was he made a gesture like this. That's the story.
Yeah. But it's a conversation.
In the conversation with Kazi?
No, with Prabhupada and his disciples on the morning walk. And they said, what, with a gun? Prabhupada says, with a holy name.
Oh, did he? I'm not aware of that. Yeah. That's very nice.
Also, I just don't want the going up there.
There's also the instance in the long purport in the Bhagavad Gita where Lord Nityananda is struck by Jagannath Madai, and Lord Chaitanya wants to kill him, and he said, no, if you kill them, you have to kill everybody. So the idea was to be very compassionate, and they became, of course, great devotees by the tolerant attitude. There was a story, Lay Miserable, something about that. Anyway, it was a story. And it was based on a guy who stole and beat up a priest, but the priest didn't. He was very tolerant. And as a result of this, this person was successful in his life. He always remembered the tolerant priest. And as a result of that, he was that's the story. He was very successful, even though he was subjected to all kinds of dangerous things. Any other comments? Yeah.
Does Saint Kirtan is orientated towards Krishna consciousness? What do you think the yogis or the fires would bring about also consciousness?
They would bring about Krishna consciousness in different ages. They were recommended fire sacrifices and so on. In this age, they're ancillary to doing things that we conduct fire sacrifices during initiations and during certain ceremonies in the temple. But they're not the main thing. Is the main sacrifice is chanting and eating prasadam and dancing, as opposed to fire sacrifices, although they are still done, because they're part of the Vedic culture, but not the primary means of attaining Krishna consciousness. They're like aids to it. Any others? Yes, then?
You mentioned that Prabhupada put emphasis on chanting rather than astrology earlier. And I was thinking that sometimes, we've seen in the past, devotees have been married in the society, marriages haven't worked out. And sometimes you could think that by chanting evokes some intelligence, that maybe astrology can be used in a way that can be practical.
Well, people do compatibility charts, I think, and it's a successful. I mean, I think the success rate is greater. So it's not to say that there isn't some value to it, or that you can just completely reject it. Because I think that Prabhupada, I heard a story that on Thursdays it's supposed to be an auspicious day, that he wouldn't travel. There's certain things that he observed, and he had astrologers that he listened to and consulted with. So it's not that, by chanting that you completely negate it. But obviously both things are there. You have to be practical and look at these things, from a practical point of view and look at them for what they are, too. So it's a big topic, but I think that it's really a combination of things. Just like if the weather is predicted to be stormy, you'll take an umbrella with you. But you'll not necessarily think that the weatherman is going to be accurate. Maybe he says it's going to rain, it's going to be sunny, that sort of thing. But we still take the umbrella, and we still think it's going to rain. Anyway, just that's just a kind of bantam view of a very deep subject. Anything else? I think we'll stop then. Thank you very much. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Bhagavatam Ki Jai. We'll carry on with that conversation next time. But I forgot.